Philadelphia, Philadelphia, are you ready? City of brotherly love, home of smoking Joe Frazier. Come on. It's about that time. FetLifeStation.com. Philly Fridays, baby. Come on.
It's your girl, Christina Reyes, with Jail Talk. Before I get started, I think it's important that the audience listening out there understand the reasoning behind Jail Talk. I have been saying for some time now we needed a platform and outlet to have conversations related to what's taking place with the prison system, the effects that it has on all parties impacted by the system, such as those who are survivors of violence, individuals incarcerated, families, and communities. My goal is bringing more awareness to the side effects of prison and helping those who aren't aware to become educated, because this can happen to anyone. In today's conversation, we give space to Chatawayo Johnson, someone that has been often spoken about in the Pennsylvania prison system because he spent not only 38 years in prison, but 38 years in solitary confinement. He was formerly incarcerated for a total of 44 years, and this man is remarkable and resilient in every way speaking. I also have Valerie Caballo, who is the Director of Communications with Straight Ahead, who will discuss legislation and solitary confinement and ways that we can organize. So first, I want to say to Chatawayo is welcome back.
Okay, welcome. Let me straighten out a few things. Now, I've done 51 years in prison. I've done 44 years in solitary confinement.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, let's set the record straight so that they can all know. Tell me, Chatawayo, how does it feel being home?
Oh, it's so wonderful.
It does?
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I'm not on the West. I'm just still on the phone.
No, you're right now. We on live. You hear Chatawayo?
Yeah, but I'm okay. All right, as long as
we on live. Yes. So I'm glad that you you set the record straight. I wanted to ask you, you know, talk to me about like when you first got incarcerated.
Well, when I first got incarcerated, I was a teenager, growing up in Philadelphia. I had just got out of street gangs. I was in street gangs. So I was about 8 years old, probably turned 17 years old. When I turned 17 years old, I had made a promise to my father that I would get out of the gangs and then I would go to the military, because that's what he wanted me to go. When I grew up, man, I used to watch these documentaries on World War One. My father served in the Korean War, 1950-1951. He always felt, though, that would have been the best thing for me. There wasn't a lot of opportunities for blacks or a lot of things to do in our neighborhood. So he always told me when I was real young, when you get up at 18 years old, I want you to go to the military. And I told him I promised that I would do that. So I got out of street gangs when I was 17 years old. And I speak of street gangs, I'm talking about the street gangs of the day. We wasn't drug gang. We was just teenagers fighting each other about girls and about neighborhoods. That was basically it.
Wow. So how did you get yourself involved in a situation like that at 12? Because that's kind of young.
No, I was eight. I was 8 years old.
8 years old?
Yeah, I was eight. Well, not Philadelphia was plagued with street gangs. Now, okay. When I say street gangs, I'm not talking about the street gangs today. We wasn't drugs. We didn't have guns. We wasn't robbing and killing and stuff like that. We were just basically fighting in our neighborhoods. We didn't want other guys from other neighborhoods to come mess with girls in our neighborhood. And we was basically like that, you know, just running around doing little low-level stuff. And that's how I got in street gangs.
Wow. So when you first got into prison, how did that feel for you? I mean, what age were you? And how?
I was 17. I was 18. I went to prison, rather. I turned 17. And August 1970, I got locked up in October 1970, 2 months after I turned 18 years old. So when I went to prison, you know, I was pretty rebellious. I'd done time in juvenile institutions. I always stayed in a lot of fights and with the counselors, stuff like that. So I went to prison. It was shocking to me because I didn't really have no experience about prison as opposed to juvenile institutions. It was hard and extremely repressive. And as a result of that, I rebelled. And rebellion, I ended up being placed in solitary confinement. It's my first time. I met some really dynamic individuals that gave me some directions. There was JoJo Bowens and Rusty Shulks Maroon. I met them. They was in solitary confinement. And we got to, we weren't allowed to talk out the doors, but we was allowed to talk. We go in the yard, these cages. So fortunately, I was able to get in cages next to them. We would talk, and they start criticizing me about life, about politics, about racial madness, and everything else in the country. And from that on, to me, that was like the best thing that ever happened to me, meeting them, because they literally transformed my life in the most goodest way I could ever think of.
And tell me, how did they transform your life?
Well, they introduced me to politics.
Okay.
And politics and world affairs and social issues, political issues, history, all things I didn't know nothing about.
Would you say that they were in the hole as long as you were in solitary confinement?
Well, at that time, we wasn't, but I just went to the hole. They was in and out. And we end up getting the pop. Well, me and Russell Schultz, Maroon, we end up getting the population together. And we got a number of things, and we really got locked up a number of times. Then when my major lockup didn't come until 1979. I went to the hole in 1979. I didn't get out to 2017.
Can I ask you a question? How does it take place that someone gets placed in solitary confinement, not just for a year, not for 30 days, but like, what is it that the DOC did when it came to you? I mean, being in the hole for that amount of time.
Well, they accused me of a lot of things. And that's what they used as a pretext and a justification to keep me in the hole. They said I was a violent, very violent escape artist. I've been in incidents with numerous guards. I was engaged in trying to escape all the time. Those things that they used to try to justify keeping me in a hole.
Were you in the same prison during that time frame, or were you at different locations? Like, did you have an opportunity to like go to different facilities, and they were still placing you in the hole?
Yes, I was into most of all the older prisons than some of the newer prisons. So now, first for the prisons, only like 5 prisons. See, but after about 20 years, it was about then the 30 prisons. So some of the newest one I went to was Green, where I spent 10 years in a solitary confinement.
Can you talk to me a little bit about what solitary confinement is? Like, what does that mean to you, being somebody who was formerly incarcerated? Just because I feel like a lot of people out listening to this show, they don't really have a good understanding of solitary confinement and the experiences that it puts an individual through.
Well, it is, to me, is the most repressive situation a human being could be put in, especially back in the 70s and 80s and the 90s. Well, you was, first of all, we was given this white jumpsuit, all white, what they was, which they was calling BAU, what stood for Behavior Adjustment Unit. You'd be in a small cell, nothing but a sink, iron bed, or concrete bunk. They had, some of them had concrete bunks, all of them had all steel beds. Most of them didn't have the windows in it, they had bars. And that's where you was. You was only given back then 10 pieces of writing paper, 10 envelopes, an ink pen you could use, a flexible ink pen to take the outside of it out and give you the inside of it. And you could use that for a few hours in the daytime, a few hours in the evening time. And that was it. You weren't allowed to talk. And you came out back then to go to the yard 5 times a week for an hour in another cage. They were just as big as, almost bigger than the cell that you was in, which is about, I guess, 7x9 cell size. Everything in the cell was steel and concrete. And you had to, back then, you said, they handcuff you backwards. You got to put your hands out the door, put your script. Strip all your clothes off. They shake them. All you have is a jumpsuit and a pair of boxers and an undershirt, a pair of socks, and some slides with sneakers. Slide on ones, and that was it. You put them out, they shake them, you put your hands out the door, they handcuff you behind your back. That's before they had, that's eventually they start giving us a lease, putting a lease on you, like a dog lease. They would attach that to the handcuffs and hold a lease and guide you that way. But in the 70s and 80s, they didn't have a lease. And you would take you to the back, when you go in these cages, like I said, by the same size as the cell, individual cages. And they bring out a number of individuals. They go into cages too. That's when you get a chance to talk to other prisoners.
Wow. So how were you able to keep like relationships with your family during that time frame?
Like I said,
and also,
go ahead.
You know, I was just going to say with other individuals within like solitary confinement, like how were you guys able to communicate?
Well, you see them when you go in the yard. That hour you get for 5 days a week, that's when you're able to talk to other prisoners. You know, you holler back and forth. If they carry you next to you, that's good. But if they wasn't, there might be 3 or 4 or 5 cages back down. You just holler back and forth to each other.
What about with your family?
Well, you got visits, but you couldn't get contact visits. You got visits behind. Some prisoners had plexiglass. Others had a screen. You behind one part of the screen, they behind the other side of the screen. You couldn't touch them or nothing like that.
Wow. So can you tell me, like, what does that feel like? Because for a person to spend so much time in prison, but then also to be kind of, you know, having the wall already between you and your family, when I'm saying wall, I mean, like, you know, law is going into prison and then you see your loved member, but your family member, but then to have like another wall, you know, in between you guys where you can't give a person a hug or a kiss or just give that contact that sometimes people need. And I feel like we need it all the time. What was that for you? Like when it came to your family?
Well, it was terrible. Not able to have contact with family like that. But I didn't have a particular expectation. Well, I didn't have an expectation that it was going to be otherwise. I went to prison. I thought that prison was brutal. So as a consequence, I was like somewhat knowing this is how it's going to be. And my family members, I would never tell my family members for a lot of years. I would never tell them because I realized early on, going through Genesis, there's nothing they can do about it. Like, I had lost my mother when I was 2 years old. So I was raised by my grandma and my father and my aunts. So my grandma was an elderly lady. I didn't want to tell her because all she would do was worry. So I would never tell her that I was in those conditions. How you doing? I'm doing okay. And that was all I would say. So I would never talk about me. I was always talking about them because I didn't want to put the burden on them of worrying, knowing that there's nothing they can do about it.
Wow. So I know that when people are in solitary confinement, you know, we don't talk about the fact that these individuals are not only being oppressed, but the fact that this also heightens a lot of mental health illnesses that individuals sometimes have. And then also it can contribute to you kind of like losing, you know, your composure. And the other thing that I also want to talk about is the fact that not only are you allowed outside, but 1 hour a day, you're 23 hours in the cell. Commissary is not being given to you the same as it would in a regular general population. Is that correct?
Well, in Sammy's age, you got no commissary. You got none. They gave you, you know, you got 3 meals a day, and that was enough. And they gave you a bar of soap, a washcloth, a towel when you went to take a shower, and that was it. So you got none of those things. Those other little things that we're able to get is a result of protesting and going on hunger strikes. And that's how eventually, in the middle of the 90s, things changed a little bit.
How did you, as an individual spending that much time in solitary confinement, how were you able to get your mind so disciplined in that space? Because, you know, during the pandemic for myself, being inside the house, you know, it gave me a lot of anxiety. I was very stressed. And not only that, but I felt kind of depressed from just not being able to socialize. Like, how did you prepare yourself in that space?
Well, part of it was that after I became more politicized, I understood that the prison job was to break you. When you know, I felt that knowing that these people are trying to break me, I was able to muster every ounce of fortitude I could get for myself to maintain myself. Because to see me break, they would have gave pleasure to them, and that would allow them, encourage them to keep doing things they were doing because they were literally destroying people. And I saw a lot of prisoners completely lose their mind. And I didn't want to be like that because I saw how the prison administration, particularly the guards, they really enjoyed that. So when you feel, though, I think when a person realized that, I believe that somebody's trying to destroy you for the activity they're subjecting you to, you fight even harder not to let that happen. So our motto has always been no retreat, no surrender. That's what me and Maroon, Jojo, and a few guys, because we used to say that, no retreat, no surrender. So you have to make sure, because you would encourage them to keep doing what they're doing by breaking us, breaking other in the prisoners.
One thing I hear about,
I suffered a lot in prison. In the South, I got my jaw broke, I got my ribs broke, I got fractured skulls as a result of guards attacking me.
Were they just attacking you? Because I hear a lot of stories. I hear that a lot of times guards are not giving people food.
Yes,
that they're doing
yes.
things
got,
to mess
yes,
with
yes.
the food.
That's routine. That's part of the routine. For a long time, we got half rations of food. It wasn't until the 90s when guys was able to put lawsuits in. The courts ordered them to give us 4 rations of food. Food, they use food as punishment. And I tell my family as I got out of prison, other individuals, one of the worst suffering that I went through was being hungry. I was hungry for over 10 straight years, every single day. And it messed you up so much. Oh, you can't really think a lot because all you want to think about is food. That's one enough to eat. They just give us a little bit of food in these little paper plates, real small ones. And the 70s, they were feeding us with a cardboard spoon. As soon as it touched warm food, it started to fold up. But that was some of the brutality and repression they were subjecting us to.
Now, I hear about this all the time, just the way that the treatment is when people are in solitary confinement, especially with correctional officers that are working those units. They're not showing any type of empathy, let alone compassion. And I kind of wanted to get Val's take on this as well, because I know that you are often talking about solitary confinement and just kind of like making people aware. Can we talk a little bit about solitary confinement and like the harm that it does to people that have been there, let alone a day? I mean, you've been there for again how many years?
Yeah. Thanks so much for having us on today. And before, as you said, I work at Straight Ahead now. And before working for Straight Ahead, I worked for Solitary Watch. And one of my first responsibilities at Solitary Watch was to read all of the letters that we received from people in solitary confinement across the country, and respond to them. And that's how I really learned what is really going on in solitary, because I think unless you know someone who's been in solitary, or unless you're deeply involved in the movement to end solitary confinement, or you have a loved one, who's been through it, you don't really know. And there are, I think, these false perceptions of what solitary confinement is that are starting to be broken down for people to actually understand. But I think for a long time, people thought it was only for the worst of the worst, and it was necessary to keep the institution safe. You know, that's the narrative that the Department of Corrections puts out. And that's straight up false. That's not torturing people makes nobody safer. It doesn't make the incarcerated person safer. It doesn't make the corrections officers safer. It doesn't make our community safer. It's the opposite. It's breaking people down. And like, I just want to say, like I have so much deep respect and admiration for people who make it through, because a lot of people don't. And the purpose of solitary confinement is to break you and sometimes kill you. And so like right now, to be in the presence of someone who endured that torture for 44 years is like an honor for me. And I want to shout out Cheddar Whale for that strength, and Joseph Jojo Bowen, and Russell Maroon Schultz, and Albert Woodfox, Herman Wallace, Robert King, you know. And if like the real origin of solitary confinement was to uphold the white supremacist system and crush Black liberation fighters. And that is not, people don't, I don't think, realize that unless you talk to someone who was in solitary confinement back then, you know, in the 60s or 70s, because it's evolved into what it is today, which is it's still used for that, but it's also used to just warehouse people, mostly with mental illness, and it causes mental illness. So if you didn't have mental health struggle before you went into solitary confinement, now you definitely do, because you have been put into a box. And as a human being, you're not meant to be cut off from the outside, from the sunshine, from other human beings. And so it's widely proven that even just a couple of days in solitary confinement causes deep, lasting psychological impacts, as well as physical. And that's something that I learned from Cheddar Whale. And it's something that I could kind of pick up on just talking to people in solitary across the country. But Chet was really the one who made that point so strongly to me that, like, yeah, we talk about the psychological effects a lot, but often we don't talk about the physical effects of, I mean, what he was talking about, not eating.
I was thinking about that too, about like the physical effects of being in solitary confinement, and as you stated, with the food and everything, but just kind of like some people staying there and maybe leaving out after a month and not even getting a haircut and not eating. And, you know, some people may have not even been given soap to like clean themselves, and people are like sharing amongst each other in that space, trying each way to connect. And then looking at yourself and you can't even recognize your appearance because you don't even look the same color anymore because of being placed in that space.
Yeah.
And you know what that's the result of? Not getting sunshine.
Exactly.
We go in South Lake Confinement, most of the prisons, you go out in the yard early in the morning. Usually about 6:30 to 7:30, you go in the yard around that time. So the sun is not out. And you go through a long period of time never getting sun on you. In fact, my last 5 or 6 years, they started a program where you had to see a medical staff like every three or four months. There was after people won all these lawsuits about people that had been in South Day for a long, long time. So they called me out and they would tell me, look, we understand you've been here for a long, long time. We'd like to give you a test to see if you're okay. So they gave me a test and they were telling me, they said, look, when you get sunshine? Do you get sunshine a lot? I told them, no, we never. So they look at the chart to see what time we go out. So they start prescribing calcium.
Vitamin D too?
Yeah, no, they didn't give us vitamin E. They just gave us calcium supplements because that's what he explained to me. He said that what the sun do is metabolize vitamin C, vitamin D in your body. And so we're going to give you these supplements. You're only 3 times a week. You can take these supplements 3 times a week. Just keep your bones strong and keep your color okay. And that's when I start learning, reading about that stuff and all. Those are one of the effects. And I mentioned to Val, one time we were trying to find, there's a report out, came out years ago. It was called South Day Confinement, Psychological and Physiological Punishment. And what it done, explained, when you talk about the physical aspect of it, it talked about the physical aspect of what South Day Confinement do to you. And because a lot of us, we thought it was only psychological, but it's physical too. It can cause rheumatism, arthritis, because you're confined in a space where still in concrete, everything in the whole cell is still in concrete. And by being in that environment, the report was talking about how it deletes the nutrients and minerals out your body and contribute to arthritis and rheumatism.
Wow. So how is it possible that people are placed into solitary confinement for this amount of time? And I guess either one of you can answer. I don't know if you want to answer the question going first, and then Chad Will, you kind of giving me your perspective on it as well.
Well, Val said something that was truthful. In early days, they were used to control people, individuals that they deem as radicals. And they would use that, and they also use them as examples to other people.
Val, can you tell me how is it that the DOC is able to keep individuals in solitary confinement for this amount of time?
Yeah, I think that the DOC tries so hard and has been quite successful in silencing people inside of prisons and creating a barrier between the general public and what happens inside of prisons. I think that that's broken down a bit, like, in the last couple decades, but essentially, there's complete immunity for corrections officers and prison administrators. You can push back in a lawsuit, you know, and there are supposed to be certain standards of human rights and decency that they follow, but oftentimes, they don't even follow their own policies because they can get away with it. It's rare that charges are brought against corrections officers and that they're actually upheld. There was a case in the feds that I think was one of the few cases in which this happened, where there was just so much evidence that came out, and it ultimately was one of the corrections officers who spilled the beans in the court, and that's why it even went anywhere. But it was a group of corrections officers, and they called themselves like the Cowboys or something, and they would just gang up on people in solitary and falsify an assault on them, on the corrections officer, that they would then come back and assault the person. So in reality, they were just assaulting people, but in the write-ups, they wrote that they were being assaulted, and they went to such lengths to fabricate the original assault. Like, one of them took a toothbrush and cut his arm and took a picture of it. And in reality, that never happened. He cut himself and took a picture of it and put it in the report. And all of this came to light in the courtroom. But in general, like, if you don't have a corrections officer who will tell the truth, which usually they don't because they band together, then you don't know what's really going on, because there's this assumption that incarcerated people aren't telling the truth.
I have a question in terms of what you're saying, and I want Chattel Whale to ask this too, but has there been any statistics done on whether race plays a big point of, like, how many people are in solitary confinement? Like, do they have, like, a ratio when it comes to that?
Well, in me particular, I never saw none, but I've been hearing different numbers. I like, before you go there, I like to add something that Valerie said that's important. You know how they was able to get away with keeping dudes in solitary confinement for a long time, like myself and other guys? Solitary confinement is broken down in different categories. They got what they call DC Max. DC means disciplinary. See, when you go to, you get a misconduct, you go to a hearing. The hearing sentence you to no more than 90 days. You can't get no more than 90 days. But what they do is, after your 90 days is up, they say they classify you as a threat to yourself and others, and a threat to the well-being of the administration. So they put you on AC stat, which means administrative custody. When you're on administrative custody, they tell the courts, when you file lawsuits and stuff, no, you are not being punished. You are being kept in solitary confinement on AC status because you are a danger to yourself and others, and you are a threat to the security of the prisons. So that's how they're able to get away with that for a long, long time.
And I also want to add, just real quick, that they're also able to get away with it because it's legal. Technically, yeah. It's legal to, at least speaking about Pennsylvania right now, it's different in each state, but it's true for most states too, that it is legal to hold people in solitary confinement almost indefinitely. And even though the United Nations has declared it to be torture and to violate international standards for holding people in solitary confinement past 15 days, we're still in a stage in the United States where each state is pushing to fight legislation to make that the law. But currently, it's typically not.
And add to that right there, and there's been a number of cases that you can read about, law cases, but the Supreme Court said, you can keep a person in solitary confinement as long as you want, but you must give them due process. And here's how they circumvent that. Due process to them only means one thing. You got to call a person from a board, and you got to tell them why they are being kept in solitary confinement. And that's what they consider as due process. And that's how they've been doing us. They call it to the PR, what they call the PRC, which means program was PRC was a program director committee, something like that. I forgot the name, what it stood for. But it was a deputy warden, the director of treatment, and director of security. Those three individuals still on this board. They bring you in front of them. They tell you, well, you've been kept in the solitary confinement because you're a threat to the well-being of the prison, and use a threat to other individuals. That's due process. And that's all the courts told them they had to do. It got to change years later, but initially, for a long time, that's all they had to do. And the Supreme, like I said, the Supreme Court has said, a person can be kept in the home, solitary confinement forever, as long as you give them due process.
So, Chattel Whale,
it was legal to keep you in solitary confinement. Once they just leave you there,
so Chattel Whale and Val, just listening to what you guys are saying, so there's no time limit as to how long an individual can be in solitary confinement. But for me, also, like, what is going on in terms of helping to rehabilitate a person besides keeping them in a cell for 23 hours a day? Like, were you allowed to take part in any type of programming? Was there any type of mental health, you know, specialist that is going down there to, like, work with individuals? Are there any, like, metrics to see, like, okay, this person's been here for way too long and has shown good behavior? Like, how is it possible to keep people in solitary confinement for this long without reassessing people to know that they have, you know, worked on themselves?
See, there was no group of, there was nobody that would monitor them. The prison just write down whatever they want. Like I'm saying, they will say, you represent a threat to the security of the prison and to yourself and to other individuals. I got so many PRC sticks that say that same old thing. To them, that's enough. And because to them, security is number one. Remember, in prison, the one most important issue out of everything is supposed is to them, security. And once they declare you as being a threat to their security, they can do whatever they want to do to you. Even use the force against you. They say, well, you engage in the activities and the guard tries to subdue you and you fight back. They can use force until you stop fighting back. So they would justify by breaking dudes up and killing people by saying you fighting back, you fight attacking them. And so they had to protect themselves and subdue you and you end up dying. That's how they got away on a lot of stuff.
Val, what's your take on it?
Well, I actually, while y'all were talking, I wanted to look up the stat that you asked about. So in regards to the racial disparity of people held in solitary confinement, in Pennsylvania, the Journal of Science Advances reported that Black men are 8.2 times more likely to spend at least a day in solitary confinement compared to white men by the age of 32. And that disparity increases to 10.6 times for periods of solitary confinement of at least a year. So it's definitely, the data shows that it is disproportionate. And we already know that the prison system itself is racially disproportionate. But it's that disparity is even further exacerbated in solitary confinement.
Well, I know, too, most of my experiments in prison, it wasn't but a handful of white prisoners that come to the hole. It was always 80-90% Black.
Mm.
Then a lot of Hispanics, a lot of Latinos start coming, then they start making up big numbers.
Wow. So, by the way, how is it that you were able to, like, I guess, talk with your family when you're in a hole and I feel like everything is being monitored and just kind of let them know that you need them? Like, how were you able to have those type of encounters, you know, just being in that space and not being able to communicate either as much as you wanted to and even trying to receive the type of help to get out of the hole?
Like I told you, my position was I never told my family because I didn't want them to worry. I realized nothing they could do. So I said, why worry them when there's nothing they could do? Whoever they write to, people don't pay them no mind. They tell the people, oh, he got in trouble. He done this, he done that, done that. So they don't really care. So I said, I'm not going to ever burden them with telling them because there's nothing they could do about it. Literally nothing at all.
So there's people at times that are feeling not only help their family, because they're not being provided the support or the resources their family members get out of solitary confinement, is what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, I'll tell you, nothing you can do. You call the prison first, and they're not going to talk to you. They're going to tell you to put you in your counselor. The counselor going to tell you, well, here's what he's done to be in solitary confinement. They read off your misconduct, all the things you supposed to have done, and that's it. You call anybody else, they tell you, well, you got to call this person. You got to put you on a runaround. So it's like a waste of time. I knew this early on, so like I said earlier, I didn't want my grandmother to worry about me because she was an elderly person. I knew nothing she could do about it. So I played strong. I'm doing okay. I'm all right. She said, "You sure? Yes, I'm okay. I'm okay." I said, "I would never talk about prison to them. I would make the conversation about family members. How's so-and-so doing? How's so-and-so doing?" That's how I done for years and years and years. When I got out, I thought my grandma passed away by the time. But I told others, they was like, "Oh, why didn't you tell us?" I said, "For what? What couldn't y'all done? Nothing. I ain't want y'all worried about me. Y'all got your own life to live."
You know what I about that you are just such a selfless person. You know, just in saying the things that you said and being in a place where, you know, you were just being oppressed. Not only that, but from stories that I've heard from other individuals, you are an inspiration because a lot of times people were placed in the hole and everyone has spoken about you with so much respect. But how were you able to find hope being in that space? Like, you know, knowing that you were there day in and day out, waking up and, you know, having to stay alone. Like, how... like find strength in being in the moment.
Like I said before, I was telling you that how I just was able to muster all the fortitude, determination I could possibly have not to let them win. In addition to that right there, I didn't want family members worrying about something happened to me. And that's always never one to pair weak to them, because when you do that, they take advantage of you. So I was into a number of physical altercations with them when they attacked me. And I never want them to know they hurt me, because I felt though, as growing up in the world, I knew that when somebody do something to you, you let them know they're doing it, they're hurting you, they do it, they keep doing it. But if you let them know, you're not hurting me, that's not nothing, you ain't do nothing. They were like, "Well, it's not really hurting me." Like, when I got my ribs broke, that's the most painful experience I ever had in my life. God broke my ribs. I laid on the floor for 2-3 days because I did not want to tell them that I was hurt, because they would just been laughing at me and making fun of it. They come past, they would call me names. I call them names back. "You ain't do nothing to me." It wasn't nothing. It took 20 y'all to gang me. I would say stuff like that. But I was hurting, suffering bad. But what can I do? When you know you're dealing with a ruthless, uncaring person, no matter what you say, it's already going to delight them, make them good about it, feel good about it. I got teeth kicked out and all of that, but I would never tell them that it was hurting me. I was suffering bad. But what can I do? I came to realization early on in prison. And here, the only thing you can do is try to get out. You can't win, because they're going to always gang you. And they're going to always frame you for stuff. So you just got to hold on as best you can. One thing I was really concerned about in addition to that was this. I wanted to always hold on to my humanity. I wanted to always have this ability that I got from my grandma. She used to always say, analyze people as individuals. So at one point, I became, glance of being racist came to my head, because most of the prisons back then all controlled by whites. Everybody was white. But always I realized that that's not good, because my grandma always taught me growing up, you got to always analyze every individual as an individual. So the whole of my humanity, I try to maintain progressive, even in the midst of all that brutal stuff. I was called all kind of racial names when they attacking me, but I said, "No, I'm gonna hold on, because this is how I want to be." And fortunately, I was able to hold on to that, and I felt the good that they didn't break me. I mean, they hurt me a lot. I was hurt a lot. And I didn't really understand the hurt part until I went to court. And I went to court at a psychiatrist. I noticed a psychiatrist that had been all around the world analyzing and studying and interviewing the prisoners that had been in South Africa for a lot of years. When he came to see me, he had talked for like 3 hours. He wrote a report and gave it to the judge. And the judge read it. And the judge had read some of his writings about South Africa confinement. And he said that I was suffering from irreversible damage. That means damage that's nothing nobody can do to make me better. That took me to that point. When Judge said he agreed with that, because he read about this guy, his name was Steve Hannity. And the judge talked to me. He asked me how did I explain to him about how I went for years without a misconduct, not getting to know no kind of problem whatsoever. Why would they not let me out of the South, out of the hole? And he told, he got on the DOC case, said, why is y'all keeping this man in the hole for all these years? And they would, they rationale, they would jump back to the same thing. Oh, he's a violent this, he do this, he do that. And the judge said, hold up, when the last time he got a misconduct? 10 years went past. No so how are you still labeling him that? Oh, he's smart, he's slick, he only doing that because he's getting population, then he's going to do other stuff. But judge wouldn't go for none of that stuff.
Was that when you were released, Chatterwell? That was a judge who helped to release you?
Yes. And the judge, I went to a district court in Harrisburg, the federal court, and the judge ordered me released from South Dakin Farm after he heard days of testimony from both sides. You know, they had their side crouches on the stand. He told them there was nothing wrong with me. I'm a strong individual, and that's out of the door. And the judge said, he could be strong. Everybody could be strong, but how long will that last? See, there's one part I didn't mention earlier. In the Supreme Court ruling about keeping you in solitary confinement forever, they made one thing they did say that allowed people to utilize. They said they cannot keep you in solitary confinement under conditions that will contribute to the destruction of your mental health. When Brett then filed the lawsuit, that was the issue that they dwelled on. They said, okay, they knew that prison was going to come and say, look, this guy, he's in perfect health. He take care of himself. He exercises every day. He do all this. But Brett them came, they got explained to the lawyer, to the psychiatrist, look, he do all of that to try to maintain himself. But how long can that last? So when the psychiatrist testified, he explained to the judge. He said, yes, Mr. Johnson is a very resilient individual. He's really strong. He's really healthy. But how long would that last if he keep being subjected to this locked down like he's being locked? He said he has never seen a prisoner subject to the things that I was being suffered. And the judge said he agreed. And the judge ordered me released.
So Chatterwell, like, there's, and Val too, and you could probably add to this, but who takes accountability for, like, the amount of years that individuals stay in the hole? And as you stated, like, your case was one of those cases that you had support and you had someone, like, you know, on your side stating what was right. But then there's other people that are still in solitary confinement right now, and there's no one there to maybe fight for them or to receive that type of support. Like, who is accountable for this taking place? Like, who do we hold accountable?
Well, we got to hold the DOC. But there are individuals like Val, myself, and other individuals, different groups, they are trying to bring a lot of attention to that. You know, they were successful in getting the United Nations to recognize that solitary confinement was a form of torture.
Yeah. I agree. Definitely the DOC. But I also think lawmakers, because they have the ability to write that rule and require the DOC to treat people humanely.
Exactly.
What about the superintendents? Like, is there something that is, I don't know, reviewed once a year? Because as you stated, you didn't have any type of, like, misconduct for that amount of time. And still and then, that was never, like, looked over. It's almost like you were being passed by and you could have been, came out of being in solitary confinement.
Well, I forgot to add something to that. There was a superintendent. They had a woman superintendent that came when I was up in Frankville. Most women, as we all know, are different than men. Most women got more compassion than men. And she wanted me out. She wanted to release me to population. But they started a new program in prisons about 10 years ago. They started what they call restricted release prisoners. And I became one of them. What means the prison cannot let you out. The warden can't let you out. Nobody in that prison. The DOC, Secretary of Corrections, got to order you released. And once I got under that status, me and a lot of my other comrades, we had no chance of getting out to the prison. The DOC had to first approve it, and you was only given a review by the DOC initially every 3 years. Then it went down to every year. And when the latest one came in, he wouldn't approve it because he was only going by what was on my record. And the judge had asked him during the hearing, he said, let me ask you something. His name was Witso. He said, let me ask you something, Mr. Witso. Why is Mr. Johnson being kept in solitary confinement for all this time? He said, Your Honor, Mr. Johnson is a very violent escape artist, and he's a very smart individual. He's going to act like that he's a changed person, which he's not. So the judge, and then the conversation went on. So the judge said, I'm asking you, but was he being kept in solitary confinement? Is it for being punished? Or is he being for things he do? So they ain't supposed to use retaliatory actions against you. But he did, but he didn't want to say it. So when the judge says, is he being, because he being punished or because he's still representing a threat? Woods who got to talk about other stuff, about the stuff I've done. And he wouldn't answer it right away. So the judge told him, you don't have to answer it because he got to understand that he wasn't going to answer it. I told Brett, my lawyer at the time, I turned around and said, we're going to win the case. I saw the expression on the judge's face. He was really mad that he asked him a straightforward question and he wouldn't answer it. He started talking about some other stuff I'm supposed to have done. So that's how they're keeping dudes in now. They're using restricted release, meaning that, like I said, the prison can't let you out. The Secretary of Corrections got to let you out.
Well, I'm glad that you stated that because that was something that I for sure was unaware of, and I think a lot of people need to know about those things that are listening. I want to know, Chatterwell, how has it been for you since being home, and how have you been able to like find some type of healing after being able to like experience all those years in solitary confinement? Like, how have you made your way back out here? Because I also know that you are, you know, a heavy advocate for helping other individuals come out of solitary confinement, especially based off of your experience. But how have you been able to heal since being home?
I'll tell you this. I didn't fully heal. I still have them moments. And I'm just struggling trying to make it. Like I remember told you earlier, I still have flashbacks. I still think I'm in solitary confinement sometimes. Like I realize I'm not. And then I met a lot of really good people, Val and other individuals, that also contribute to that because it lets you know how, in the midst of all that repressive, there's some good people out here that's trying to help other people and do good things, trying to make the country a better country for everybody. And that right there means a lot to me because in prison, you see so much repression, so much hate. And when you come out and you see people out here that's so good, so progressive, and trying to do things, it makes you feel better. Good, good. You say, hold on, the world is a wonderful place. It's just some individuals that's messed up.
Definitely. I'm glad that, you know, you're home. I'm glad that someone looked over at your case and they seen that things weren't being done the right way. You know, and the fact that you're resilient and that you're able to tell your story and to share it, and not only that, but you've inspired so many other people that I don't even know if you realize that at times that your story is one of those stories that I know for me, I'm thinking about it, and in thinking about it, I'm also reflecting on other people that are still in solitary confinement that, you know, they are cared about, they're loved, and they also, they need support. They need to have people talk about this legislation. And Val, can you kind of, I know during the show, we have what's called a jail call, and it's 15 minutes where, you know, we want people to get educated and know ways that they can organize or help to find a solution to this problem. Can you talk about the legislation right now that's taking place so that can be our jail call for today?
Yeah, definitely. And thanks for opening that up. So there are pieces of legislation across the country that different states are pushing to pass to restrict the use of solitary confinement to 15 days in alignment with the Mandela Rules, which is the United Nations statement that I referred to earlier. in Pennsylvania, we had HB 1037 and SB 685 introduced last year to do just that, to restrict the use of solitary confinement to 15 days and for no more than 20 days within a 60-day period, so that, you know, you can't be like, oh, you in for 50 days and then you out for a day and then you back in. And especially providing protection for vulnerable populations such as elderly people, pregnant people, kids, people with mental illness or intellectual disability, and LGBTQIA people. So there's similar legislation like in California that's on the table. In New York, they passed it. So another struggle is, one struggle is getting it passed. And we've definitely faced opposition in Pennsylvania with this legislation. But having said that, I do feel like there's a renewed energy to get it passed with the recent progressive political shift. But New York is an example, and New Jersey as well, where they did pass similar legislation that bans the use of solitary confinement past 15 days. The problem is that the implementation, it's a new thing. And so, like, these states don't necessarily have experience with the challenge of implementation, because as we talked about earlier, prison administrators and correctional officers essentially have immunity from being prosecuted. And so they break it. They find loopholes. You know, they use a different name, or they make a different unit that's called a step down program when really it's just solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And so another, like in Pennsylvania right now, what we're focusing on is how to write the legislation in a way and set ourselves up for success in implementation that prevents all those loopholes, that sets up methods of accountability and oversight. So it's not just, okay, the legislators are trusting that the DOC is doing it, because we know they're not going to do it if we don't hold them accountable. So setting up structures of accountability that aren't just the DOC themselves, but are community boards of people who don't have a conflict of interest. And so in Philly, we're setting up, we're pushing for an oversight board of the Philadelphia jails. And so we're starting from that point, so that then when we pass a ban on solitary confinement, we have a board that can enforce it. So yeah, people can tap in on hrcoalition.org. And also, you can find resources at solitarywatch.org, as well as unlocktheboxcampaign.org. So Unlock the Box is the national campaign to end solitary confinement that will give you all the different information. So if you're in a different state than Pennsylvania, you can tap into whatever state you're in and the movement on the ground there.
Well, Valerie, I want to say thank you for sharing that information with our listeners. I want to thank you, Chad Awayo, for coming on and being so resilient and remarkable and just strong and sharing your story. I also want people out there knowing, in order to make these changes, we need you to, like, get up. We need you to speak. We need you to talk to your legislators, because this can happen to anyone. And I want to thank you both for coming on to Jail Talk today and, you know, just sharing this information. Solitary confinement is still taking place right now. People are in solitary confinement in this moment. And, you know, they are loved. They shouldn't be oppressed. And we need to start getting them out of those really harsh punishments while being in prison. So I thank you both for coming on.
I thank you for inviting me, because I want to be able to spread the message about solitary confinement so people can have a better understanding.
Thank you, Chad Awayo. And not for nothing, but I know that people listening, you know, me included, just having the conversation with you and knowing you, you know, you're inspiring a lot of people out there. Thank you.
Now, again, thank you for having me on.
Thanks. So next up, I live with Suave Gonzalez and Kevin McCracken. Again, you guys can listen in on Jail Talk every Friday at 4.
So this will be on every Friday at 4. I'm going to start doing this.
Testify for you. I do that 3-4 times again. I testify for you. I sort of like you, that bitch. I do it all that I'm around. You scared to do. I'm not. Long as you joking, now in for me. I ain't got it. Mobbing, scheming, looting, hide your bodies. Long as you dreaming about me, ain't no problem. I don't got nobody just with you right now. Tell the truth, I look better under you. I can't lose.